Trina's daughter?
Yes.
You and Trina are pretty close, aren't you?
Yes, we are. He didn't say anything more, but he still didn't leave. I was impatient, partly because I needed to get back into town, partly because spending time with Keith was like watching a movie highlights reel showing off all of my questionable decisions in life. I didn't know what he was expecting. I was hoping it wasn't sex because I wasn't entirely sure I would say no. Whatever else had happened between us, I still felt the same old attraction to him. "What do you want, Keith?" I asked finally. "What are you doing here?" He didn't answer immediately. Then he shrugged and said,
"I hate being home these days. I feel like Colleen is haunting me."
"I'm sorry to hear that. But as they say in the bars, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here."
"I know. This is awkward for you. It is for me, too. When I saw you yesterday, I was reminded of all the rough edges we left behind. I suppose there's nothing we can do about that."
"No, there isn't."
"Okay, I'll go."
As Keith went by me onto the threshold, he was close enough to brush past my body, which gave me a little shock of electricity. Then he turned around before I closed the door.
"One more thing, Shelby."
"What is it?"
"I also wanted to tell you, just so we're very clear about it, I had nothing to do with Jeremiah's disappearance."
His words came out of nowhere, and I couldn't hide my surprise. "Why would I think you did? Is there something you haven't told me?"
"No."
"Do you know anything about what happened to him?"
"Nothing at all."
"Then why say something like that?"
"Because sooner or later, I'll be a suspect. And I want you to know right now that I'm innocent."
"What makes you think you'll be a suspect?" Keith shook his head sadly. He flipped his hair back again.
"Because of Colleen. Because the whole town thinks I murdered her. I guarantee you people are already making up stories about me and Jeremiah. They need someone they can blame for this, right or wrong, and I'm the easy choice. Everybody is looking for an Ursulina, Shelby. They won't stop until they find one."
After Keith left, I wondered if he was right. Were people really talking about him as a suspect? And if so, what were they saying about me? I didn't think anyone knew about my affair with Keith, but I might have been naive about that. Everyone saw us hanging out together after the Halloween fair. It doesn't take much more than that to get whispers flying through the town. Rumors are like motor oil here, lubing up every conversation, and sex is a favorite topic. I wouldn't have been surprised to find out that tongues had been wagging about me and Keith. My relationship with him was a one-time thing, literally one time. But the damage was already done. Little wonder I had decided at that point in my life that I was better off without dating, romance, hookups, or sex. Between my job and my friends, I didn't have time for men. Some of the local guys would have liked to change my mind, but the rule of numbers in a small town meant that pickings were slim. Sure, I dated. Most people around here figured my high school boyfriend and I would get married, but that was never going to happen. He was cute, and you have to learn about sex somewhere, but I knew it was a short-term thing. After that, I went out a few times and endured a few fix-ups. None of them turned into anything serious. And then there was Keith. By the morning after Halloween, I was already regretting what had happened with him. Actually, I was regretting it as I drove home overnight. Keith phoned the next day, but I ducked his call. He called four more times over the next week, and I let all of them go to voicemail. I was determined to never talk to him or see him again. That lasted until the evening of November 14th, when Adam and I responded to the 911 call at his house. We found Colleen Whalen dead in the tall grass, shot in the head. Keith said he'd come home from a hiking trip and found her. He blamed a burglar for the crime. He said much of his wife's jewelry was missing, including her wedding ring and an expensive watch she'd given him for their anniversary. And a gun. A gun he owned had disappeared, too. There was no way to prove he was lying, and no way to prove he was telling the truth. Did my father believe him? No. Did Adam? No. But not believing someone didn't mean you could put them in jail. Did the people of everywhere believe him? No. The rumors and gossip in town all declared Keith guilty. What about me? Did I believe him? I'd thought about that question for months, but I still had no answer. All I knew is that while I was standing over Colleen's body, Adam asked Keith how things were in their marriage, and Keith replied, "Fine." That was a lie. I knew it was a lie, but I didn't say a word. Chapter 12. I met my father at the Nowhere Cafe an hour later. He hadn't slept at all, but sometime during the night he'd ironed his uniform, and his hat wasn't even a single degree off kilter. He was eating a plate of scrambled eggs and bacon at the counter, and he had the newspaper folded in front of him to the daily crossword puzzle. Breezy was late getting to work, and the coffee pot in the diner was already getting dangerously low. Everything looked normal around here, but in fact, nothing was normal at all. This was Saturday, day two. Jeremiah had been gone for an entire night. "Morning, Dad," I said as I took the seat next to him at the counter.
"Hello, Shelby. Did you sleep?"
"A little. I wish you had, too."
"Something tells me I'll have plenty of free time when the FBI arrives."
"So they're really coming?"
"The governor called me personally to ask for my cooperation. Also, the statewide media has picked up the story. It's all over the TV news. I imagine we're going to be inundated very soon."
I looked around at our sleepy cafe. It wouldn't be sleepy here much longer. We were about to be swarmed by strangers asking questions, giving us suspicious looks, digging into our private lives, and studying our behavior as if we were exotic animals at the zoo. Cops, reporters, volunteers, gawkers. You could almost feel the town holding its breath, waiting for the invasion like the return of the mayflies. Most of us who live here don't really trust outsiders, for the simple reason that outsiders who come here don't really trust us. "Maybe it's a good thing," I said, trying to put the best spin on what was ahead. "We need more manpower. We need technology. This is bigger than us, Dad. It's all about Jeremiah."
"Of course it is.
Plus, it's not like they don't need us. We know the area. We know the people. They don't."
"You're right."
But being right didn't change the fact that this was our town, our people, our boy, and our mystery. And the whole investigation was about to be taken out of our hands. We didn't have to like it. I heard the jingle of the diner's front door. Breezy flew in 90 minutes late, looking stressed and breathless. In unison, everyone in the booths silently pointed their fingers at the empty coffee pot behind the counter. She stopped at the door long enough to tie up her ponytail, triggering disgruntled rumbling from those of us who needed more caffeine.
"Yeah, yeah, keep your pants on," she announced loudly. "Dudley wouldn't start again."
Dudley was her 1998 Ford Escort, which she'd nursed through 20 years of Middle County winters. The patient had been on life support for a while. When it ran, its engine sounded like a bicycle with a baseball card taped in the spokes. Breezy had been working extra shifts morning and night to save money for another car, but as fast as she earned it, she spent it on other things. She went behind the counter, and the aroma of the brewer soon took the edge off everyone's nerves. While we waited, Breezy leaned her elbows on the counter in front of me and Dad.
"Any news?"
I shook my head.
"Hell's bells," Breezy said. "I hear the FBI's coming, is that right?"
"They are," my father replied.
"Soon?"
"Any minute."
Breezy looked around the cafe with a hungry expression that was different from what the rest of us felt. I could read her mind. For her, the arrival of strangers meant tables crowded with out-of-towners who left large tips. That may sound heartless, but I couldn't really blame her. Newcomers meant money in the cash registers of the local economy. It didn't matter why they were here. "How's Dudley?" I asked. Breezy swore.
"The starter just grinds. We may be near the end of the road.
How'd you get here?
I called Monica and she gave me a lift on her way in. Hell if I know how I'm getting home tonight.
I knew Breezy, and I wasn't worried. With men pouring into town, she'd have plenty of offers for a ride.
Hey, you're right, by the way,
she told me. About what?
The Grooters are back. I couldn't sleep. They were playing their radio in the woods half the night. You know what that means?
Yes, I knew what that meant. More meth around the county. More emergency calls to the hospital in Stanton. More lives ruined. On any other morning, that would have been our first priority. Breezy went off to pour coffee for the rest of the diner. Dad studied the clues of the crossword, but I noticed that he hadn't filled in a single word. His pencil sat unused on the counter, its point perfectly sharp. Dad liked to say that chaos began with the littlest of things, like a dull pencil. He picked up the paper and squinted at the puzzle. This wasn't just entertainment for him. He did crossword puzzles because he'd read that doing them was like calisthenics for the brain. He knew he was struggling. I knew it too. Apparently, everyone in town knew. 16 across, I said, peering at the paper. That's an easy one. 10 letters. The beacon in the storm. Dad blinked as he reflected on the clue, but the answer didn't come. He stroked his snow-white mustache and grimaced. I think that moment was the first time I ever saw him as old.
I guess I'm more tired than I thought, Shelby.
Lighthouse, I prompted him. He stared at the empty little squares on the page.
Yes, of course. What was I thinking?
He picked up the pencil, wrote L in the first box, and then put it down again without finishing. He turned over the newspaper and instead focused on the mug of coffee that Breezy had placed in front of him.
I really didn't think it was possible,
he said to me in a quiet voice.
I didn't want to believe it. A child abduction. Here.
We're not cut off from the world, Dad.
No, I suppose not.
My father took a sip of coffee and glanced over his shoulder at the others in the diner.
Everyone's saying it must have been a stranger who took him. They don't want to consider the other possibility.
What do you mean?
It might not be a stranger at all. It might be one of us.
I didn't say anything, but I realized that Keith Whalen had been right. Soon we would all be turning on each other. We'd be looking for someone to blame. We'd be hunting for an Ursulina hiding among us. The bell on the diner front door jingled again. Monica Constant pushed into the cafe like a little tornado. She had an enormous satchel purse draped over one shoulder that looked as if it weighed as much as she did, and she wore a flouncy pink dress that was decades out of style. Her brown eyes were huge behind round glasses. She patted her kinky strawberry hair to make sure it was just so, and then she took a seat on the counter chair next to me, where her feet dangled well above the floor. The first thing she did was remove a velvet case from inside the purse and put the urn for Moody, her dead dog, on the paper placemat. The urn was 6 inches high, made of turquoise ceramic, and hand-painted with lilies of the valley.
Hello, you two,
Monica squeaked. Dad turned his head and gave her his usual charming smile and then picked up his newspaper again. Good morning, Monica, I said. She tapped a fingernail on the placemat and gave me a pointed look. And good morning to you too, Moody, I added.
Thank you, dear,
she said with a playful dance of her eyebrows. Then she dug a sheaf of papers out of the deep bowels of her purse.
I checked at the office before coming over here. I have the summary of overnight calls.
Is there anything that could be connected to Jeremiah?
Dad asked.
Not that I can see. I'm sorry.
Did the Stanton police track down old Mr. Nadler? I asked, hoping for a little good news.
Well, if they did, they didn't send out a follow-up report. Not that this would be the first time things fell through the cracks over there. I'll call later and find out.
Thanks. Breezy showed up in front of us again with a cup of hot Twinings tea and a blackberry scone.
Here you go, Monica, my treat. Thanks for the lift this morning. You saved me. Oh, please. Which tree is right on my way, dear? I was happy to do it.
Monica lived an hour's drive from everywhere in a small town called Sugar Fall on the western edge of the county. On some winter mornings, her commute took 2 hours or more. Even so, she was typically at the office ahead of all of us, and I couldn't remember a day she'd missed for weather or sickness. She was a rock. I watched her dip the tea bag in her cup and nibble at the scone by picking off pieces with her red-nailed fingers. To me, she'd always been ageless, the kind of woman who looked the same year after year. She was precise and organized, with a great memory for details, which made her a perfect partner for Dad at work. I was pretty sure she'd thought about being a partner for Dad in other ways, too, but he'd always been too busy as a sheriff and father to think about getting married. Dad gave up on the crossword puzzle. He slapped down the paper with obvious frustration and stood up from the counter.
I'm heading to the office.
Okay, I'll be there in a minute, I told him. He left, tipping his hat to the others in the diner. They smiled back at him uncomfortably. Monica's eyes followed him discreetly as he headed out the door and across the street toward the Carnegie Library.
He's not very good today, is he?
She said. Not very good, I agreed.
Stress makes it worse. He'll bounce back.
I hope so.
He's going to need you, dear. Are you ready for that?
Of course I am. She patted my back.
Well, count on me to help you, Shelby. Believe me, this situation will grow you up fast.
She meant nothing by her comment, but I felt a little annoyed. It made me realize that the people around here still saw me as young. 25 years old, but not grown up, not ready for life. Monica, Dad, Adam, Trina, Ellen. To them, I was just a kid. And maybe they were right. I was still the girl who didn't know who she was or why she was alive. I still didn't know why God had bothered to save me, and I didn't feel any closer to figuring it out. But I had no time to think about myself. From somewhere outside, distantly, I heard the guttural throb of an engine getting closer. Monica and I both looked at each other in confusion. The others in the cafe heard it too, and people gravitated from their booths to the diner window and then outside to the street, where a crowd was gathering. I hurried outside with Monica next to me. The throb got louder, almost deafening, making all of us cover our ears. I looked up in the sky and saw a black helicopter slowly descending toward the open grass yard in front of the courthouse. Down it came like some giant insect, and when it was nearly on the ground, I could see white letters painted on the side. FBI. Monica leaned toward me as the helicopter engine cut out and the rotor blades slowed.
An unwanted visitor in a tableware emporium, she murmured in my ear.
I shook my head, not sure what she meant.
Remember Tom's crossword clue yesterday? We were talking about a bull in a china shop. Well, dear, now we've got one.
Chapter 13. Special Agent Bentley Reed of the FBI didn't look impressed with the basement office of the Middle County Sheriff's Department. He was a city man, and this was the country. He was as tall as my father, with mocha-colored skin, thinning hair that gave him a very high forehead, and a trimmed goatee flecked with gray. He was dressed in a pinstriped blue suit with leather shoes shined to such a bright finish that I was scared to look at them directly for fear of blindness. He was smart. I could see that in his eyes, which moved fast and didn't miss a thing. I guessed that he was in his 40s, and he had the bearing of an ex-military man. He didn't walk. He strutted. He didn't talk. He commanded. Violet introduced him to us, and we all got the message loud and clear. Bentley Reed was in charge. Our entire county team was gathered in the basement, about a dozen of us. Dad had called in all the shifts for the early morning meeting. I stood next to Adam, who was quietly seething at the prospect of taking a back seat to the feds. Adam never took orders well, even from my father. Agent Reed took off his suit coat and folded it carefully over the back of a chair. He stood in the center of the room with 8 other federal agents behind him, eyeing the surroundings with the same disdain their boss did. I could feel their impatience, the pros staring at the small-town cops who'd wasted so much time before calling them in. Reed had a throaty voice like a drumbeat that filled the room.
Sheriff Ginn, I want to thank you for making your whole team available to us and for your partnership in this investigation. My colleagues and I are members of the FBI's Child Abduction Rapid Deployment Team, and we have one goal. That's to find Jeremiah Sloan and bring him home safely to his family. Unfortunately, he's already been missing approximately 19 hours. That's not good. In a potential abduction situation, every second counts, so we're already playing catch-up and we need to move swiftly.
I glanced at Dad, whose face was as blank as marble before it was carved. He knew he was being chastised.
Jeremiah could still be lost in the woods, he pointed out.
Reed nodded.
Yes, we're aware of that possibility. We have heat-sensing technology in the helicopter, and we'll be launching a grid search over the forest in less than an hour. Of course, again, time has hurt us here. If Jeremiah spent a night outside, the boy's body temperature has likely dropped. That will make him harder to detect. As far as a ground search goes, one of my team is a veteran of wilderness search and rescue operations, and he'll be leading the search process and coordinating volunteers from the general public. As news gets out about this case, we're going to have a lot of people showing up to help, which is both good and bad. I know you've had locals out searching already, but we'll be going over the entire area again from the beginning.
Translation: who knows what you people missed?
Next, let's talk about the sex offender registry,
Agent Reed went on.
Where do we stand on interviews with people on the list?
We haven't talked to anyone yet,
Dad began, but Reed cut him off.
So we're nowhere on that. Got it. Okay. We've identified nearly 100 level 2 and level 3 sex offenders in Middle and Stanton counties. I want in-person interviews and alibis from every single one of them. Talk to their neighbors, too, and show them Jeremiah's photo. I also want the state patrol showing that photo at every gas station at every exit on the interstate. Ditto for every gas station within a 200-mile radius of the National Forest. If Jeremiah was taken out of the area, this guy had to fill up somewhere. And let's get copies of the guest registers from every motel and resort in both counties so we can run them against criminal records.
Behind Agent Reed, his team keyed notes furiously into their phones. Several of them were already coordinating their next moves with each other in whispered tones. These people had worked together before, and I couldn't help but be impressed. Reed may have been arrogant and condescending when you met him, but he was a pro. Violet had been smart to bring him in, as painful as it was for me to admit.
We need a command post, Reed went on. Large, somewhere we can set up our computers and process physical evidence as we gather it. Ms. Rocha, what do you suggest? What's available in town?
There's a gym at the school, Violet proposed. Will that work? It's wide open and no one's using it during the summer. We've got power in this space and we can bring in dozens of tables as needed.
Perfect,
Reed went on. He jabbed a finger at a special agent on his right who didn't look much older than me.
Next, media. Tiffany Ball is our media relations specialist. We're already getting plenty of queries, but we want to control the message, so Tiffany will be working with all of you and the boys' parents to craft a press release, profile, and media kit regarding the disappearance. Same for social media. I expect to hold a press conference early this afternoon once our infrastructure is in place. Questions on any of that?
My father and the rest of us stood in shell-shocked silence. Life moved at a slow pace in Middle County. Not so at the FBI.
Excuse me, Special Agent Reed?
It was Adam. He stepped ahead of the other members of our team and squared his shoulders.
Yes,
Reed said.
You have a question? Yes, sir. I'm Adam Twilley. I'm Sheriff Ginn's senior deputy.
There was no such thing as a senior deputy, but that didn't stop Adam from staking his claim to the job. Agent Reed looked Adam up and down from his boots to his curly brown hair and analyzed him like a computer. I could tell what the printout in his head said, and I'm pretty sure Adam could, too. Lightweight. It wasn't fair, but Adam didn't always give the best first impression. He looked like what he was, a kid with a motorcycle.
Okay, Senior Deputy Twilly, what's your question? I want to know what our role is going to be.
Reed's face bent into the tiniest smile.
Well, right now I sure as hell could use a cup of coffee, if you wouldn't mind.
The agents broke into laughter that went on longer than was comfortable for any of us. Adam's face turned several shades of crimson.
I'm kidding, Deputy, Reed went on. All of you have an extremely important role to play. You know this area backwards and forwards. You know the people. You know the roads, businesses, all the things that we don't. So we're counting on you to give us your expertise on everything local. Make sense? Sheriff, you on board with that?
My father nodded his agreement.
We'll give you anything you need. We know every inch of this county, that's for sure. I'm sure you can count on our colleagues in Stanton to help on their end.
Excellent. I have a suggestion,
Adam broke in, pushing his luck with Agent Reed.
You should probably designate a liaison between you and your team and the police here and in Stanton. Someone who can coordinate the flow of information between us. Make sure nothing gets missed.
A liaison? Are you volunteering, Senior Deputy Twilly?
If you want me to, sure, I'd be happy to do that.
Reed stroked his chin with his thumb and gave Adam another careful look.
Well, the idea of a local liaison working directly with me is a good one. I like your suggestion, Twilly. However, the last thing I want to do is come in here and deprive Sheriff Ginn of his senior deputy. That doesn't seem right.
Adam's face fell as he realized he was being passed over for the assignment that he'd suggested. Instead, Reed's gaze floated around the room from person to person among the sheriff's team. It landed on me.
You,
he said, jabbing a finger in my direction.
What's your name?
Deputy Shelby Lake.
Not a senior deputy?
Reed said with a flash of his white teeth. I couldn't help smiling, too. No, sir, just a deputy.
How long have you been with the department?
7 years.
Reed turned to my father.
Sheriff, do you have any problem with assigning Deputy Lake to me during this investigation?
I watched Violet open her mouth to object, but then she closed it again without saying anything.
None at all,
Dad replied. He gave me the fastest little wink.
All right. Deputy Lake, if you're okay with that, consider yourself conscripted.
Of course. Thank you, sir.
That'll be all for now, everyone,
Reed continued.
You'll have assignments in 15 minutes, and senior staff will meet again before the press conference in 3 hours. Remember, everybody, we've got a 10-year-old boy out there. Let's go find him.
That was all. I was afraid that Adam was going to have a stroke. He shot me a look that was black with jealousy and rage. Adam and I liked each other, and none of this was my fault, but I knew this was going to be a problem between us. As the meeting broke up, he stormed out of the basement without a word to anyone else. Agent Reed watched him go. He knew what he'd done, and he didn't care. Of course, I wasn't dumb. I knew why Reed had picked me. He assumed I was young, I was pliable, and I would do what I was told.
Deputy Lake?
Agent Reed towered in front of me.
The first thing I want to do is talk to the Sloanes. I'd like you with me.
Absolutely.
Just so we're clear, the parents are suspects until we prove otherwise. That's not for public consumption, but when things like this happen, it's usually somebody close to the child. Our first job is to rule the parents out so we can move on to others. Got it?
Got it.
Ditto the brother. What's his name? Adrian? I want to re-interview him about exactly what happened out there.
I wasn't sure I should say anything, but I barreled ahead anyway. In fact, sir, I'm a little concerned that Adrian hasn't told us everything he knows. Reed studied me with a glint in his eyes.
Oh? How so?
I explained about the Gruders and about the burrs on their pants. I was ready for Reed to dismiss my suspicions the way my father and Adam had, but instead, he called one of his agents over immediately and asked for background research on Will and Vince. Then he turned back to me and gave me a thumbs up.
"That's an excellent observation, Deputy," he told me. "Has anyone talked to Adrian about this yet?"
I glanced at Dad, who was close enough to overhear, and I felt like a traitor. "No."
"Well, let's talk to him right now and get to the bottom of this. If he's hiding something, we need to know what it is. The fact is, I never met a 16-year-old boy yet who didn't lie the first time you asked him a question."
Chapter 14.
"Any affairs?"
Agent Reed asked me. I eyed him across the front seat of my cruiser as we drove down the highway toward the Sloan House. My guilt about Keith Whalen was the first thing that popped into my head, and I hoped it didn't show on my face. "I'm sorry, what?"
"Dennis and Ellen Sloan. Is there any talk around town about either of them cheating?"
"Why does that matter?"
"When people try to cover up affairs, bad things tend to happen. We always have to be conscious of possible motives."
"Well, there's been gossip about Dennis for a long time. I don't know whether any of it's true. He also drinks more than he should. He's had a couple of DUIs over the years."
"And Ellen?"
"Not that I've heard about. She's a straight arrow."
"What about money problems?"
"I don't think so. Ellen's store does well, and Dennis must make a pretty good living with the forestry department. I imagine they'll be inheriting money and land from her father now, too. He passed away a couple of weeks ago."
"What about abuse? Violence? Any calls for domestic disturbance at their place?"
"No, nothing like that. We get our share of domestic issues, but I've never heard about a problem with the Sloanes." I added after a moment, "It must be ugly for you and your team, always looking for the worst in people." Reed watched the trees going by on the highway. His long legs were squeezed under the dashboard.
"I find kids. We've got a 90% success rate doing that. Nothing else matters."
"I wasn't saying..."
"I know what you were saying, Deputy. And yes, you're right. It's ugly sometimes. The reason I ask these questions is that people who have secrets typically don't like to share them. They lie to their spouses, they lie to their friends, they lie to their doctors, they lie to cops. Even when their kid's life is at stake, they lie. Honestly, I don't care where Dennis Sloan sticks his dick. I care whether he's being blackmailed about it, or whether some girl he dumped has a grudge against him, or whether his kid saw Daddy doing something he shouldn't and told somebody else about it. All those things make kids disappear."
Like I said, Reed was smart and tough, and he wasn't going to let anyone's feelings get in the way of what he had to do. When I listened to him talk, I could hear an unwanted visitor stampeding through the china shop, with dishes crashing to the floor in his wake. We arrived at the Sloan House. Before we got out of the cruiser, Reed opened the glove compartment and grabbed a listing of the vehicle's mechanical specs in a plastic slipcover. He shoved the plastic case inside his suit coat pocket. "What are you doing?" I asked. "What's that for?"
"Visual aid,"
he replied without further explanation. Ellen and Dennis met us at the door. Their faces were drawn, and their eyes were red with tears and exhaustion. There were others inside the house with them, just as there had been the previous day. Relatives, friends, kids from Adrian's school. Trina must have finally gone home because I didn't see her. Everyone looked fragile, as if tensing for the moment when the phone would ring and they would find out whether the news was good or bad. The teenagers clustered around Adrian. The men clustered around Dennis. The women fussed and looked busy and left Ellen alone. She was independent and needed her space. Agent Reed introduced himself with firm handshakes for both parents. He was an entirely different man in front of the Sloanes. His hostile impatience vanished. He radiated compassion. And yet I watched his eyes and knew he was registering everything in the room and taking the measure of all the people who were gathered there.
"Is there a place we can talk?"
he asked.
"Somewhere private?"
Dennis nodded and led us downstairs. The walkout basement was a man cave, built with log beams and stuffed with toys. Large screen television, pool table, an old-style slot machine from a Vegas casino. It was just the five of us, Ellen, Dennis, Adrian, Agent Reed, and me. The adults sat on a leather sofa near the television, and Adrian staked out a high-top chair at the wet bar. I kept an eye on him. The boy squirmed like a caterpillar on a hot sidewalk. Reed took them through a long checklist of everything that was being done. The sheer length of the list made it sound like the whole world was looking for Jeremiah. I could see visible relief on Ellen's face, and she shot me a quick, "I told you so," look. That was fine. Anything that gave her a moment's comfort was fine with me. Then Reed shifted gears.
"One thing I need from you right away, Mr. and Mrs. Sloan, is a list of all the adults in Jeremiah's life."
Ellen took a moment to focus. "What?"
"Teachers, doctors, friends, co-workers, neighbors, any adults that Jeremiah would see on a regular basis."
"Why do you need that?"
"We want to talk to all of them."
"Oh, well, of course we can do that. Dennis and I will sit down and come up with names."
"Thank you."
The real meaning of Reed's question only dawned on Ellen slowly, and I watched a horrified realization grow on her face. What he was saying was, someone close to you could have done this. You can't trust anyone. Your friends are all suspects.
"Mr. Sloan, how did you find out that Jeremiah was missing?" Reed asked. "I was at the ranger's office when Adrian came running in." "Who else was there?" "Two other rangers were with me. There were a few tourists, too. A married couple from Iowa, I think. And 2 20-somethings with backpacks." "Were these other rangers in the office with you all day?"
"Yeah, they were."
"And do you have a registry of people who were camping on the National Forest grounds on Friday?"
"Sure, we have that."
"I'll need a copy."
"Yeah, of course. You bet."
"Mrs. Sloan, what about you?"
Reed continued.
"How did you find out about Jeremiah?"
Ellen had been watching the back and forth with her husband carefully.
"Dennis called me. I was at the mini-mart. And yes, Agent Reed, I can give you the names of any number of customers who can verify that I was there all day."
Reed offered her a sympathetic smile. He knew she'd figured it out. First, make sure the parents weren't involved.
"I appreciate that. Please understand that this kind of information is necessary as part of our routine background in a case like this."
Then he swung around to face the teenager in the high-top chair.
"It's Adrian, right? Come on over here and join us."
His tone made it clear that this wasn't just a suggestion. Adrian slid off the chair and took a seat on the sofa far from his mother and father. He stared at his feet and ran both hands through his hair, leaving it messy. He had the same thick black hair as his father.
"You a football player?"
Reed asked with a friendly smile.
"You've got the build for it."
"Yeah, I am."
"So was I. High school and college, too. What do you play, tackle?"
"Yeah."
"I figured. Okay, Adrian, I know you're worried about your brother. We all are. I know you want to help us find him. So I need you to answer some questions. It's very important that you be honest with me."
The boy shrugged.
"Sure."
"First of all, do you know two brothers named Will and Vince Gruder?"
Adrian looked up sharply and realized that Reed's pleasant smile had vanished. The whites in the boy's eyes grew 3 times larger. His reaction told me I'd been right about Adrian not being alone in the National Forest. I knew it told Agent Reed the same thing.
"The Gruders?"
Dennis interrupted with a puzzled expression.
"What do they have to do with this?" "Adrian?"
Reed asked quietly.
"Yeah, sure, I know them. Everybody does."
"Are they friends of yours?"
"No, I just know them. That's all."
"I hear they sell drugs."
"Maybe. I guess. I don't know."
"When did you last see them?"
The boy shifted nervously on the sofa.
"I don't remember."
"Were they in the campground with you yesterday?"
Adrian didn't answer, and Reed leaned forward. His stare made the boy wilt.
I'm asking you a question, son. Were you with Will and Vince Gruder yesterday before your brother disappeared?
The Sloanes looked back and forth between Adrian and Agent Reed, and they began to realize that their son had been lying to all of us.
Adrian! Dennis interjected like the snap of a whip. Answer the man's question! Were you with those two assholes?
No, no way. I was alone. I told the sheriff that.
Reed slid the plastic case with my cruiser's mechanical specs partly out of his coat pocket.
Adrian, do you know what this is? It's a search warrant that gives me the right to search your bedroom. See, I think you did some business with the Gruders yesterday, and I think we're going to find evidence of whatever you bought in your room. Now we can all wait until I finish my search, or you can save us the time and tell us what I'm going to find in there.
The silence ticked away for a few seconds, but to Adrian it must have felt like hours. Finally, he murmured, as if speaking in a whisper would hide the truth from his parents.
Meth.
Meth?
Ellen screamed and shot to her feet.
Are you crazy? Are you out of your mind? What are you doing with something like that? Why would you have anything like that in your room? Adrian, say something.
Agent Reed stood up too, and he put up his hands for calm.
Mrs. Sloan, I know this is upsetting, but right now let's keep the focus on Jeremiah. For the moment, this isn't about drugs, it's about finding your son. Adrian, I'm going to ask you again. Did you meet Will and Vince Gruder yesterday while you were out with your brother?
The teenager began to cry. Tears streamed down his cheeks and his chest heaved. He could barely choke out the word.
Yeah.
We didn't have time to ask more questions. Dennis flew off the sofa. He was over his son in a split second.
You lying sack of... You made this happen! You did this to your brother!
Agent Reed and I both leaped across the space, but we were too late. Before we could get there in time to stop it, Dennis Sloan sent a fist flying with an awful crack of bone into Adrian's mouth. Chapter 15. When we arrived at the school that was being transformed into the FBI command post, I found Violet standing among the red lockers that we used to haunt as teenagers. There was a display case on the wall highlighting photos and mementos from our championship volleyball season. I stood next to her, shoulder to shoulder, and we didn't speak right away. In one of the photos behind the glass, I could see the two of us, both diving for the same ball and nearly cracking heads. Trina had had to work long and hard to keep us from getting in each other's faces.
You were good, I told her, like a peace offering.
So were you. Wow, you had a serve.
But you were better on the court. Violet nodded as if that wasn't even a matter for debate.
It seems like a long time ago.
Yes, it sure does.
The same 7 years had passed for both of us, but I couldn't help thinking that Violet had grown up faster. She was only a few months older than me, but she was already a lawyer and serving on the county board. People listened to her and respected her. Soon enough, she'd be running the whole area.
We were stars back then, Violet went on. That was cool.
Well, you're still a star.
She glanced at me to see if I was kidding, which I wasn't.
Didn't you like it?
She asked. The attention? No, not really. To me, it was about winning the game. I didn't care about anything else.
Interesting.
Violet turned away from the display case and was done with nostalgia.
How are things going with Special Agent Reed?
He's good. You were right to bring him in.
I know.
I'm sure you think he should have taken Adam with him, not me.
Adam has more experience, but Agent Reed knows what he wants.
I wasn't sure if she intended a double entendre with that comment.
I heard there was some excitement, she went on.
Yes, there was. Dennis hit Adrian.
Dennis,
Violet said, with a sneer in her voice that made it clear she was no fan.
I wish I could say I was surprised. How is Adrian?
Swollen jaw, a couple of loose teeth.
Did you arrest Dennis?
Adrian begged us not to. So did Ellen.
Given everything that's going on, we didn't think it would help the situation to have Dennis cooling his heels behind bars. He feels bad about what he did. But Adrian lied about what happened in the forest, so I understand why Dennis is upset. If we'd known about the Gruters up front, that might have changed the whole search.
What does Ellen say? Was this the first time?
You mean that Dennis struck Adrian?
That he struck either of the boys.
So she says.
Well, if Ellen says that, you can take it to the bank. And I'm sure she would have told me if there had been problems before.
I knew that Violet and Ellen had a close history together. When Violet's family had first moved to the area, she was an outsider who didn't fit in. She was a smart, pretty girl from the city joining a school with kids who'd been together in the same cliques their whole lives. It was a tough transition, and I didn't make it easier for her. She was just as good as me on the volleyball team, which I resented because I was used to being the best. So it's not like I gave her a warm welcome. No one in town did. Except Ellen Sloan. Ellen hired Violet as a part-time worker at the mini-mart. They worked together nearly every day during the school years and throughout the summer months while Violet was in high school and college. It was Ellen who really saw something special in her and encouraged her not just to go to law school, but to come back to this area after she did. I thought Violet would be gone from Middle County just as fast as she could, but she proved me wrong.
What about Adrian?
Violet asked.
Is he in trouble?
He says what he bought was for his own use, an experiment. There wasn't enough to sell, and he's underage, first-time offense. Plus, we want him to talk so we can finally get the Gruters for distribution. He'll need a lawyer, but chances are he can get off without jail time, and eventually he can get his record expunged. Violet nodded.
I'm going over there later. Ellen asked me to spend the evening with her. I'll make sure they get a good lawyer who can work everything out.
I'm glad.
Where are the Gruters? Have you found them?
Yes, they were over in Stanton. The police picked them up and are bringing them back here.
I hope they know something useful about Jeremiah.
I hope so, too.
Well, I'll let you get back to Agent Reed.
Violet walked away, but then she hesitated and retraced her steps. She was taller and thinner than me, and she was dressed in style.
It's not personal, you know,
she told me. What's that?
My disagreement with Sheriff Ginn.
He's my father. That makes it personal to me.
I understand, but you have to face reality. Tom has done great work for this county for decades, but he's not fit for the demands of the job anymore.
I disagree. And that's up to the voters, not you.
It's up to the county board if we think there's a problem.
He's fine, I said sharply. Violet put a hand on my shoulder, which I shrugged off impatiently.
No, Shelby,
she told me with more caring and concern than I would have expected.
He's not fine. He's getting worse. Sooner or later, you'll see that for yourself.
Chapter 16. Will and Vince Gruter sat like greasy bookends on either end of the bleachers in the gym. Their hands were cuffed behind their backs. As usual, I didn't know which was which. Both of them wore tie-dye tank tops from an El Paso bar with a logo of a drunk parrot on the front. I was sure they knew why they'd been brought in, but they made a point of looking unimpressed with the FBI men in their suits.
So which one are you?
Agent Reed asked the first of the brothers.
Vince. Okay, Vince, let's not waste time. You're in trouble. So is your brother. Judges are tired of meth wreaking havoc in their towns. Making and selling it will get you 10 years, maybe more.
I don't know what you're talking about,
Vince replied.
Adrian Sloan says you do. He says you sold him drugs.
Adrian Sloan can say whatever he wants, but he's lying. The Stanton police didn't find anything on us. Go ahead and search our place in Witchtree, man. It's clean. You can play tough guy all you want, but you've got nothing.
I was standing next to Reed, and I reacted hotly and jumped into the middle of the interrogation. We know you've got a lab in the woods, Vince. You were blasting music out there half the night.
Wasn't us. We were sleeping like babies.
Reed bent forward and leaned his foot on the bleacher.
Look, Vince, you're not stupid. You know what this is all about. We're more interested in finding Jeremiah Sloan than we are in you. If you tell us what happened with Jeremiah and Adrian yesterday afternoon, we'll talk to a judge about going easy on the drug charges. This is a one-time-only daily deal. Grab it before it's gone.
Oh, yeah? Well, I'm not buying what you're selling.
Reed straightened up and casually jerked a thumb at one of his colleagues.
Okay, forget it. Get this one out of here. I'll talk to his brother. Nobody says the deal has to be for both of them. One's all I need. My brother's got nothing to say,
Vince retorted loudly. As he was yanked to his feet, he repeated in a voice that Will could hear on the other end of the bleachers.
You got that? Will's not saying nothing to any of you.
Reed waited until Vince was dragged out of the gym. Then he shoved his hands in his suit pockets and wandered down to the far side of the bleachers, where Will Gruder danced uncomfortably on his butt cheeks as he waited for us. Reed took his time before talking. He sat down next to Will, too close for comfort, and casually stretched out his arms on the bench behind him. Will tried to mimic his brother's tough guy pose, but it didn't work.
You must be Will,
Reed said after a while.
Yeah? So what? Your brother tells me he's not interested in a deal. Are you smarter than he is?
We don't need a deal. We haven't done anything.
Sure, I believe you. Trouble is, I'm not the one you need to convince. Who's a judge going to like better, Will? A dropout like you who's been in trouble since he was 14? Or some nice small-town football player like Adrian Sloan? A kid whose little brother is missing? That wins a lot of sympathy points with people. In fact, what's a jury going to think when they hear that you and Vince were out there in the National Forest with Adrian when Jeremiah disappeared? They're going to assume you two had something to do with that.
We didn't, Will burst out.
He nodded his head at me.
She saw us, her and that other cop, Twilly. We were here at the school playing basketball yesterday. Then we went to the bar in Witchtree and we were there until after midnight. No way we had anything to do with that kid going missing.
But you were out there, right? The two of you met Adrian in the campground and you sold him meth. He already told us you did.
Reed squeezed in until he was practically breathing in Will's ear.
Come on, kid. We're talking about a missing 10-year-old boy. Help us out. If you give us a clue and we find him, hell, you'll be a hero. A judge is going to like that.
Will glanced at the far end of the bleachers to make sure that Vince wasn't in the gym anymore. His nose was running, and with his hands cuffed, he couldn't do anything about it, so he bent over to wipe his face on his knee.
I'm not talking about drugs. You can't ask me about that, got it? I'm not saying anything about what went down with Adrian.
Reed cocked his head at me. He shot me a look that said, This is your town. What do you want to do? All right, no drugs, I interjected. But we better like what you have to say, Will.
We didn't have anything to do with that kid going missing. No way. We didn't even know about it until you and Twilly told us.
But you were there, I said. Will's knee bounced nervously.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, we were there.
What happened?
Nothing. Nothing happened. That's what I'm saying. Vince and me, we set up a meeting with Adrian in the campground. We were supposed to meet him like 1 o'clock or so.
To do what?
To do whatever. I told you no questions about that. Got it?
I nodded. Okay, no questions. Go on. When did you and Vince get there?
Like 1:15. Adrian was there, but so was his little brother. Vince wasn't happy about that, and the kid was being annoying, getting in our faces and asking all sorts of questions. What were we doing? What were we talking about? Vince figured the kid was going to blab to his parents about seeing us, so he told Adrian either the kid goes or the meeting's off.
What happened?
Adrian told his brother to beat it. Said he should take his bike and start heading back to the ranger's office. He said he'd catch up with him in a little bit.
What time was that? I asked.
I don't know, 1:30 maybe?
Did Jeremiah go?
He argued for a while, but Adrian gave him $10. That did it. The boy got on his bike and took off.
Which way?
South.
You're sure? Away from the lake?
Yeah, back toward the ranger station.
What did you and Vince do?
We wrapped up our business with Adrian, then the three of us smoked for a while and hung out. Around 2 o'clock or so, Vince figured we better blow, so we got in the Bronco and left. Adrian said he was going to have another cigarette, so he stayed behind.
I was practically holding my breath. Did you see Jeremiah?
We saw his bike.
Where?
Tipped over on the side of the road, like a mile south of the campground.
Did you see the boy? I asked.
No.
Did you stop?
No. We figured the kid was in the woods taking a leak or something. No big deal. We didn't think anything was wrong.
So Jeremiah left at 1:30, and you left half an hour later. Is that right?
About that, yeah.
When you were in the campground, did any vehicles pass by on the road? Or did you see any people?
Nah, it was quiet.
I shook my head in frustration. I couldn't believe we could get this far and come away with nothing. We knew approximately when the boy had disappeared, but beyond that, we were no closer to finding him. Agent Reed was unhappy, too.
Okay, deputy, let's get this piece of crap out of here.
You're letting me go?
Will asked. Reed scowled at him.
Hell no, nobody's letting you go. You're dealing meth. The county cops are going to lock you up, and then 12 nice people of Middle County are going to send you away for a long time. You and your brother.
I took Will by the shoulder and began to push him toward the other end of the gym, but he broke away from me and spun around, nearly falling down.
Wait, 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 I've got more. We can talk. We can do a deal. Vince and me, we saw something.
Agent Reed stood up from the bleachers. His dark eyes shot through Will like lasers.
What did you see?
First a deal, no charges. You forget about what Adrian Sloan told you.
We're not making any promises until we hear what you have to say.
Will looked back and forth between my face and Agent Reed's. His nose was running again, and he was in full panic mode, watching the next 10 years of his life tick by behind the bars of a cell.
A truck!
He sputtered. Reed's eyes narrowed.
What?
As we were driving north toward the campground, we passed a truck. It was maybe 2-3 miles before we got there. Thing was on the side of the road. Parked, engine running, local plates, but I don't remember the license. There was somebody inside, but we couldn't see who it was.
One person? Or more than one? I asked.
I only saw one.
Man or woman?
I'm telling you, I don't know.
What kind of truck?
White, Will replied. A big pickup. An F-150. Look, I don't know who was in it, but they were just hanging out there on the road. When we headed back south later, the truck was gone. So was the kid.
Chapter 17. A white F-150. You couldn't pick a more popular truck around these parts, but on the day Jeremiah disappeared, a white F-150 had been reported stolen in the lakeside town of Martin's Point, which was 50 miles south of us. That didn't sound like a coincidence. When I checked with Monica, she told me that the truck hadn't been found yet, which was unusual for stolen vehicles around here. Most joyriders abandoned them within a couple of hours. Agent Reed and I made the drive to Martin's Point. 50 miles probably sounds like a long way, but to us, it's a trip to the dentist, shopping for a new coat, lunch with a friend. When you live out here, you get used to driving an hour to do just about anything.
There's a whole lot of nothing in this place,
Reed commented after we'd driven 10 miles on the highway without seeing another soul.
Living here would drive me crazy.
Time moves a little slower in the country, I agreed.
It does that when you're dead, too.
Let me guess. You're a city man, Agent Reed.
I am.
Where did you grow up?
Minneapolis.
Well, you weren't all that far from the North Woods living there, right? A couple of hours?
Yeah, but I didn't get much farther than uptown when I was a kid. I like having people around. Trees, not so much. I know small-town people probably hate cities, but give me a downtown neighborhood any day. This might as well be the dark side of the moon.
I'd heard that sentiment from visitors many times before. I don't have anything against cities. I love going to the city. Most of us around here do. But then we're happy to head home and leave you with the traffic and the noise and the pollution.
Well, you're right about the traffic,
Reed said. Then he changed to an entirely new subject and took me by surprise.
Tell me about the murder here last fall.
I knew what he was talking about, but I froze and said stupidly, "Murder?"
Was there more than one?
He asked slyly. No.
Okay, then. Violet tells me that a woman was shot and killed here last November. Her husband was a suspect, but the sheriff didn't have enough evidence to make a case against him.
That's right. The victim's name was Colleen Whalen. Her husband is Keith.
So give me the details.
Do you think the murder has something to do with Jeremiah's disappearance?
Probably not, but murder isn't a common occurrence around here. Neither is child abduction. When two unusual events happen in the same area, my first instinct is to wonder whether they might be connected. Plus, Violet says that the victim's house isn't far from the Sloan house. They were neighbors, right?
Yes.
Okay. You tell me. Could there be a connection?
I don't see how. Colleen's murder was months ago, November 14th.
Tell me what happened.
All right. I blinked as I drove, thinking about that day. I was shocked at how quickly Keith had been proven right. The FBI had only been in town for a few hours, and already he was on their radar screen. I was also focused on the sky ahead of us. Over the trees, I could see dark clouds pushing our way, blotting out the sun. A summer storm was getting closer.
Deputy?
Reed asked. Sorry. Looks like severe weather coming in. I was thinking about Jeremiah. A kid in a storm, you know? I don't like it.
Neither do I.
Anyway, November 14th was a Saturday, I went on, rattling off the details we'd unearthed in the investigation. Colleen Whalen spent most of the day shopping in Stanton. She had dinner by herself at an Applebee's restaurant and paid the check at 7:45 p.m. There was nothing on her credit card after that and no calls on her cell phone. If she went straight home, it would have taken her about an hour to make the drive. That puts her back in town around 9 p.m.
And her husband?
Keith Whalen says he was out hiking all day at Shelby Lake. Reed looked at me curiously. Yes, that's how I got my name. Long story. Keith said he had a sandwich in his car in a parking area near the lake. He fell asleep. When he woke up, it was late in the evening. He headed home, but says he didn't get back until almost midnight. He found his wife dead in the grass outside their house with the front door open. She'd been shot in the head. He called 911, and I responded to the call along with Deputy Twilley. There was no gun found at the crime scene. When we searched the house, we saw that a jewelry box in the master bedroom had been rifled. Keith said that an expensive watch had been taken from his nightstand, too. And Colleen's wedding ring wasn't on her finger.
So the idea is that his wife came home and interrupted a burglar who killed her and escaped.
Yes.
Is that a common thing around here? Armed robbery?
No.
Were there any witnesses who could confirm that Whalen was at Shelby Lake, like he said, or what time he got home?
No.
Did Whalen own a gun?
Yes. He told us that he owned a Taurus centerfire revolver, but that it was missing. The caliber of the bullet we recovered from Colleen Whalen was consistent with a gun like that, but of course, without the gun itself, we couldn't test it.
And what did Mr. Whalen say about the state of his marriage?
Reed asked. I gripped the wheel tightly. He said it was fine.
Did his neighbors agree? I hear it's tough to keep a secret in a small town.
Keith has a troubled past, I said carefully. He lost a leg in Afghanistan. He suffers from depression and probably PTSD. It's safe to say his marriage showed the strains of that. Colleen worked with Ellen Sloan at the mini-mart, and Ellen told us that Colleen wasn't happy.
So the murder victim knew Jeremiah's mother?
Yes, but I wouldn't read too much into that. Everyone knows everyone else around here.
Reed pursed his lips. Keith Whalen was never charged in the murder?
No. Honestly, the sheriff didn't believe Keith's story, but there was no way to prove that a burglar didn't do it. He talked it over with the county attorney, and they concluded there was too much reasonable doubt to get it past a jury.
Probably true, Reed agreed. Then he added, Do you know what kind of vehicle Keith Whalen drives?
A Toyota Highlander, I think.
So not a white Ford F-150?
I turned my head and stared at him. No.
Good to know.
After that, we were silent until we reached Martin's Point. Martin's Point is built on the shore of the region's largest lake, much bigger than any of the other lakes in Middle County. It was a quiet little town for a long time, but the city people had discovered it about 25 years earlier. They built summer homes all around the lakeshore, and upscale resorts and B&Bs had sprung up to accommodate vacationers. Antique shops and gourmet restaurants followed. The success of Martin's Point took its toll on the other towns in the county. Some of the rustic cabin resorts that had prospered for decades went under as tourists found more upscale amenities by the lake. You can still find the ruins of several old resorts deep in the woods, slowly being overrun by Mother Nature. My most vivid memory of Martin's Point was taking Anna there on a Sunday afternoon 5 years earlier. That was when Carl and Trina were away in Chicago for her cancer surgery. Anna was 5 years old then, but already smart for her age. She knew something was wrong with her mother. I took this beautiful blonde child to the lake, where we cruised on my father's boat under the bright sunshine. We fished, and Anna caught a crappie. She struggled to hold the slippery, squirming fish in her small hands and giggled the whole time, until it stopped struggling as it died. I watched Anna shake the fish as if to wake it up. When it didn't, she bawled, and it took me most of an hour to get her to stop. When she was finally calm again, she wiped her face and asked me,
Is that what's going to happen to my mom?
That was when I started crying, too. That night, when we were back at her house, I stood outside her bedroom and listened to her pray before she went to sleep. Over and over, she said,
God, I'm sorry for killing the